You are not the president or the vice president's lawyer.
He won a case, a big case.
Your loyalty is not to me.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many.
It's to the law.
Well, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly.
The Constitution.
He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney.
People of this nation to guarantee justice.
Which makes me perhaps the most innocent man anywhere in the history of the United States.
This is Ken White, former federal prosecutor, criminal defense attorney, and your host here on All the President's Lawyers. This podcast is about the legal problems of presidents and their associates, because all presidents have legal problems, but some have more than others. My co-host Josh Barrow is getting some well-deserved time off this week. So I'm very excited to have a special guest today, someone whose work I've been reading for the better part of two decades. Our guest today is David Latt. David is a lawyer, a writer, and a journalist. He started out as an assistant United States attorney doing appellate work in New Jersey. And after that, he went on to found one of the most popular and well-known legal sites in the industry, Above the Law, that covered the trials and travails of lawyers and legal culture. He has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and a number of other publications, and now he's writing for a Substack that he founded, Original Jurisdiction. Hello, David. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me, Ken. It's great to be here.
So, I very much enjoyed a new article you recently posted on your Substack, Original Jurisdiction, called Trump Derangement Syndrome, Four Leading Lawyers Who Lost It Defending the Donald. Now, usually Trump Derangement Syndrome is sort of a derisive term used to describe people who people think are too critical of Trump, but that's not what you were talking about here, is it?
No. The theory that I was advancing was that Trump derangement syndrome, or TDS, as some people like to call it, can afflict conservatives as well as liberals. And in my case, as you mentioned, I identified four lawyers, very distinguished lawyers with impressive resumes, who I think essentially lost their sanity in defending Donald Trump. So that's my version, or what I've called my more virulent strain of TDS.
Now, it's fair to say you had to sort of dig through to narrow it down to four here, because there's been a lot of litigation concerning the 2020 election and issues springing from it. But you wound up with four people. At least two of them are very familiar to our readers. Rudy Giuliani, a frequent mention here, and Sidney Powell, who really burst into widespread familiarity in the 2020 election litigation. But let's start by talking a little bit about two of the others you mentioned. Start with Jeffrey Clark. Tell me about Jeffrey Clark.
So Jeff Clark was a fixture in DC legal circles for quite some time. He is a Harvard College and Georgetown law grad. And for many years, he worked at Kirkland and Ellis, which is a very prestigious and profitable large law firm. He did two stints in government, one in 2001 to 2005 as a deputy assistant attorney general at the DOJ in the Environmental and Natural Resources Division. Clark is an environmental lawyer, although more defending against environmental claims than representing plaintiffs. Then he went back to Kirkland after that. And then most recently, in the Trump administration, he served as the head of the Environmental and Natural Resources Division. But the reason he essentially came on the scene and became more widely known is that near the end of the Trump administration, he essentially, according to reporting by the New York Times, conspired with Trump in this really bizarre scheme where Trump would fire the acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, who was actually Clark's former partner at Kirkland and his friend, put Clark in that role, and then Clark, as acting attorney general, would use his power as the acting head of the Justice Department to lean on Georgia and its lawmakers to try and get them to change their state's 2020 presidential election results. So Jeff went from being a fairly obscure, a well-respected DC lawyer into a notorious participant in the attempt to overturn the 2020 election.
Now, it didn't work, obviously, and our listeners will recall that we've mentioned this incident before. What ultimately stopped this from working? Was it someone with a cooler head? Was it just sort of the chaos of the Trump administration during these days? Why didn't it work?
I would say the former, people with cooler heads. What essentially happened was other top DOJ officials, including Jeffrey Rosen, essentially threatened Trump with a 2021 version of the Saturday night massacre. They said that they would all resign en masse if Trump and Clark went ahead with that plan. And you can imagine the chaos that would have ensued if all the heads of DOJ divisions essentially left as one big group. So eventually Trump backed down and he and Clark never proceeded with that plan. So that's an example of lawyers acting in some ways as the heroes. I feel that you and Josh often talk about lawyers who are creating problems, but here at least some group of lawyers stood up, I think, for what is right.
And I think it's fair to say that even though sometimes we paint this as an issue between conservative and liberal, that just as Clark is someone we would normally associate as conservative, so are some of the lawyers who ultimately put the brakes on this scheme.
Yes, exactly. Jeffrey Rosen is a fixture in conservative legal circles. Steve Engel, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, another prominent conservative lawyer. John Demers, head of the National Security Division, a former Scalia clerk. This is not a partisan issue. A lot of the people who stood up to Trump and Clark, I would say all of them, really, they're Republican appointees. They're conservatives, or what would be considered conservatives by many.
Well, let's move on and talk to the next person on your list, who has become, in the last couple of weeks, I think, more widely known and controversial, and that's John Eastman. So we first really, I think, heard about John Eastman widely before the election when he wrote a rather controversial and incendiary article opining that Kamala Harris was not eligible to be the vice president of the United States and therefore not the president either because her parents were immigrants and not citizens themselves when she was born. What happened after that, though?
So that article was interesting, Ken, because I viewed it as a hint of his future lunacy, as I put it in my article. But after that, Eastman continued to be involved in Trump-related legal circles. When Texas filed that lawsuit to try and essentially reverse the results of the presidential election and took that to the Supreme Court, John Eastman filed a brief on behalf of President Trump seeking to intervene in that lawsuit and support it. Then, of course, as your listeners know, that went nowhere, but John Eastman continued to be involved. And behind the scenes, he urged Vice President Pence to toss out the results of the election instead of certifying them in his role as Senate president. And then finally, when that didn't work, John Eastman spoke at a rally on the near the Capitol on January 6th, essentially exhorting people to try to oppose the election results. And he also, in that speech, advanced all sorts of crazy conspiracy theories about secret folders that were casting the ballots of voters who hadn't voted. So John Eastman went from being a, I would say, again, well-regarded conservative legal intellectual. He was a professor at Chapman Law School out in California. He was the dean of that law school for a time. He's a former law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas. He also worked at Kirkland and Ellis at one point. He went from being a well-respected lawyer to being the propagator of these really, first this fringe theory about questioning birthright citizenship, the point you mentioned about Vice President Harris, and then being one of the people who tried to get the results of the election overturned.
Now, you said he spoke at a January 6th rally, but I mean, this is the January 6th rally, right? This is the one at which Trump and Giuliani both made statements that they've been sued for, that we've talked a lot about on this show, that you know, whether or not they come close to meeting the Brandenburg standard for incitement of violence, and I still think they probably don't, this was an extremely incendiary event.
Yes, absolutely. John Eastman was introduced at the January 6th rally by Giuliani.
Well, there's a real honor. So, and you know, he's in the news because of this memo that came out, right? These sort of a 6-point action plan with bullet points about how Pence could go about, you know, reversing the result of the election through parliamentary procedure. Now, obviously, I have my own views about this, and having read it, I kind of think it's, to quote one of my favorite movies, sort of authentic frontier gibberish. But I mean, is there anything there? Is this like some sort of respectable, even moderately mainstream conservative legal theory that's showing up in Eastman's memo?
No, not at all, at least not in my opinion. And I would note that his memo, which came out last week, I think, or became public last week, has been criticized on both sides of the aisle. Jonathan Adler, who's a conservative or libertarian law professor, wrote an analysis explaining the many flaws in Eastman's analysis. Derek Mueller, who's another law professor like Eastman, did a similar takedown. So I really don't think that the memo was credible. Some of the quote-unquote facts that it rests upon are not facts. I think he had a claim that several states, seven states, something like that, had submitted competing slates of electors, which is simply not true. So really, these were examples of alternative facts, as we came to say in the Trump days.
And I think at this point, one thing I've been noticing, and maybe you have as well, is that many of Twitter's finest legal minds are asserting that what Eastman did was a seditious conspiracy to set up this plan by which Pence could throw the election to Trump, notwithstanding the actual election results. I mean, in my view, I think that the seditious conspiracy statute likely requires some deliberate involvement of violence, force. And whatever you can say about this colloquially being sedition or colloquially morally treasonous, my sense is it does not actually, for better or worse, violate federal law. Have you given that any thought? Do you have any thoughts on, you know, whether this weirdo memo actually crosses the line into some sort of crime?
I agree with you, Ken, and I know you discussed this on a past episode as well. I don't think it crosses the line. I think in many ways it's reprehensible and it's wrong-headed, but the standard for finding somebody guilty of treason is a rather high one, and understandably so. So I wouldn't go that far. But that said, I think it was really, I think as Jonathan Adler put it, poor lawyering in defense of a disreputable cause, I think. So again, I don't mean to go easy on Eastman, but I don't know that it quite satisfies the treason standard. Although, as you noted, many other people disagree.
So I think, again, something worth pointing out here, and I know that we're going to get tons of pushback that I've turned into some sort of arch conservative by pointing this out, is that it's more mainstream conservatives who pushed back against this in the moment, too, that the people who told Pence, no, you can't do that, are more mainstream people, including a blast from our past, Dan Quayle, former vice president of the United States, perhaps not generally reputed as a legal scholar, but who said, no, you just can't do that.
Yep. And there were others, too. John Eastman clerked before Clarence Thomas for Judge J. Michael Luttig of the Fourth Circuit, who was a very highly regarded conservative judge. And Eastman's former boss, Judge Luttig, went on Twitter and also, I think, went on Twitter. And then later, people arguing before Vice President Pence cited Judge Luttig's Twitter thread saying, no, this is not the case. The vice president's role is really ministerial in terms of presiding over that vote count. So you had Quayle, you had Judge Luttig, you had, again, the people in the Department of Justice who said no dice to this. One of the other people besides Jeffrey Rosen was a lawyer by the name of Richard Donahue, who was the acting deputy attorney general, the number two spot at the Justice Department at the time. And he sent an internal email to Jeff Clark when Clark wanted to send a letter to Georgia saying, there is no way I would sign this letter, no way in hell. So I agree with you. This was not a conservative liberal issue or a Republican Democratic issue. I think it was a sane, insane issue.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the other two people on your Trump derangement syndrome list and some new things that one of them, Sidney Powell, has been getting up to. You're listening to all the president's lawyers on KCRW. Hi, it's Ken White, and you're back with us on KCRW's All the President's Lawyers with my special guest, author and legal commentator, David Latt. David, there's a thread running through the people on your list, Eastman and Clark, who we've just talked about, and Giuliani and Powell, who we will. I believe they're all members of the same conservative legal organization, the Federalist Society.
I have not checked that officially, but they certainly move in those circles and have, I would think all of them have done events. In terms of official membership, sometimes people are members, sometimes they're just sympathizers. But I would suspect that some or all of them have either been official members or have done events with FedSoc.
Right. And you know, before anyone thinks that you're some sort of anti-Federalist Society partisan, I mean, you were actually the head of a chapter of it in law school, if memory serves.
So a vice president, actually. But yes, and I am sympathetic to many of the values of the Federalist Society in terms of separation of powers and the rule of law and judicial restraint. So I think that the Federalist Society, I know this is probably going to not thrill all listeners, but I am not anti-Federalist Society.
You know, one thing that's been controversial recently is what should a group like the Federalist Society, sort of a group that stands for certain legal interpretations and values, do when people who are members, people who have in the past been invited to speak at their events, act up like this? Because it seems that, you know, the types of things that happened here, Clark's plan, however far-fetched, however unsuccessful, to wind up as acting attorney general, or Eastman's sort of mutton-headed plan to have Pence overturn the results of the election. Are these so extreme that an organization should, as a whole, stand up and say something about it? And that's been a matter of controversy with, I think that the a number of the members that I know and respect have said basically that's not the way the organization works. We don't denounce members or prior members. If they're on our website, it's because they've given talks for us in the past. It's not an endorsement. But I think that position has become somewhat controversial. And there's been a fair amount of pressure, and I think you covered it in your post, about whether or not the Federalist Society should come out and say something or do something about these people when they've acted like this.
Yes, that's right. Back in January, I actually wrote a much more detailed post about the Federalist Society in the wake of January 6th. And in my reporting, I interviewed a number of prominent members who did call upon the Society to condemn the January 6th attacks. One of them was Jeremy Rosen, who's a prominent California appellate lawyer who was actually nominated to the federal bench under President Trump. Another one was Greg Nunziata, Irina Monta. I quoted a number of members of the Society who did want the Society to speak up and do something. But as you note, Ken, it is the Society's policy, party line, whatever you want to call it, that they don't take stances on issues and they don't condemn members. And so they did not take any action at the time or since.
Yeah, it's my understanding that Eastman had been the chair of a Federalist Society practice group, perhaps ironically, the Federalism and Separation of Powers group. And sometime after January 6th, he ceased to be the chair of that and someone else has taken over without a whole lot of explicit announcement or discussion of how that came to be.
That's right. We don't exactly know when that transition happened. There were a number of us, including myself, who felt that the Society should have removed Eastman immediately from that position. Instead, it happened quietly and at some point later. And in the course of my reporting for the piece I just published about Trump derangement syndrome, I did learn that the removal of Eastman from that role was actually in the works for quite some time because essentially he's retired or semi-retired. But after January 6th, the switch was actually delayed a little bit because the Society did not want to appear to be caving to pressure. One thing to understand about the Federalist Society as an organization of conservative or libertarian or right of center lawyers is It is very resistant to so-called cancel culture. And so FedSoc did not want it to look like they had, quote unquote, canceled Eastman. And so I think, funnily enough, Eastman probably would have been booted more quickly, but because of the January 6th events and his involvement in them, it actually got slow rolled, as my source put it.
Well, I mean, someone needs to stand up against cancel culture. I mean, if you can get canceled just for using complete legal gibberish to try to overthrow the republic, I mean, what will happen next? Where will we be? Let's move on to our friend Rudy Giuliani. And I think it's appropriate to think about him now as we're approaching on November 7th, of course, the first anniversary of the Four Seasons Total Landscaping Day, which I always look forward to, although I think it's gotten a little commercial. You kind of struggled a little bit in your article to figure out who had descended the furthest into madness, whether or not Giuliani took that crown or whether it was someone else. Is Giuliani's descent really a legal one or a political one, do you think?
Gosh, I think both. I think one thing to remember about Giuliani is he was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. We're both former federal prosecutors. We know how big a deal that is. He was the top federal prosecutor for Manhattan. That's one of the most respected offices in the country. The other alums include people like Preet Bharara and Mary Jo White and all of these really esteemed and distinguished lawyers. At one point, Giuliani was also the associate attorney general, the number three position at the Justice Department. He's a graduate of NYU Law. He's a former law clerk to a federal judge in the Southern District. He's no slouch when it comes to legal credentials. And also political. I think we forget, again, because of how he disgraced himself in recent years, he was once a front runner, really, for the presidential election, or at least the Republican nomination. So even if he may not have been the craziest of the four lawyers, I think his descent reputationally has been the deepest because he started out the highest. He was a national hero. He was America's mayor, as Oprah put it. He was Time's Person of the Year. And now, as you mentioned, he was this laughingstock appearing in the parking lot of this landscape company with his hair dye or mascara or whatever the heck that was, melting off his face. So my gosh, how far he has fallen.
And of course, we've been talking a lot on this show about how he's clearly under investigation by the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office, which he once led. And you know, his bar card for New York is in jeopardy as a result of some of the representations he made in court in the course of attacking the outcome of the 2020 election. So it is quite a descent. I think I agree with you that it's both a political and legal one. But I think after 9/11 and after him sort of assuming the mantle of America's mayor, people more strongly associated him with the political rather than the legal. And I mean, the legal positions he held, although they certainly are prestigious, were kind of more leadership-based and less practitioner-based is the way I'd put it. So in my experience, the U.S. attorney of a particular district isn't necessarily the most brilliant practitioner because there's definitely a political and organizational component to it and not so much a who can make the best argument or who can write the best brief component to it.
That's true. And sometimes when the U.S. attorney does their old, let me handle one trial, sometimes they do this once a year or once every 2 years or something. Sometimes they don't win the trial. So you're right. It is much more of a leadership and administrative role than in the trenches. But don't forget, when he was a young prosecutor, Giuliani was a star. He once cross-examined one corrupt politician so adeptly that the politician stepped down from the stand mid-trial and then pleaded guilty. So again, Giuliani was no slouch in the early days. He's just become a joke now, where in one of the election lawsuits, he couldn't even answer a basic question about the standard of review. So again, he went from being a courtroom star to a courtroom dud.
Point of order, David. I think he did answer the question, and the answer was,
<That's right. laughs>
which is the standard review? It's the usual one or the regular
one? The normal
one. Which. Right.
That's right. I stand corrected. He did answer it, just not well.
Right. Right. It was kind of like Sarah Palin's famous answer to what magazine she read. She said all of them. So Yeah, it is kind of shocking, the descent of actual legal skill. Well, let's talk about the last on your list, Sidney Powell. Again, someone who's really burst into national attention with the controversy and litigation surrounding the 2020 election, and now really is making up for lost time in terms of consuming public attention. Does she have a respectable background that makes her fit in this list of formerly respectable people?
Oh, absolutely. She graduated from a top law school from UNC. She's originally from North Carolina. And then she did appellate work, which is a very intellectual specialty, as an assistant U.S. attorney. She served under multiple U.S. attorneys for about a decade. And then she moved into white-collar defense work. And she did have a brush with fame prior to the 2020 elections, because she represented Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor to Trump. And her original approach to his defense in terms of trying to withdraw his guilty plea after he made it and alleging prosecutorial misconduct and speculating about some kind of deep state conspiracy originally struck many observers as crazy. But as I say in the article, it was like crazy like a fox, because it actually worked, at least in Trump world. The DOJ moved to drop the prosecution. And then when that kind of ran into a little judicial resistance, Trump just straight up pardoned Flynn. So Powell was an effective lawyer in a weird way. Her tactics were, I would say, unorthodox, but she got the desired result for her client in that case.
Right. And we talked about that a lot here on the show, the delta between what's an effective legal tactic and what's an effective political tactic, and how so many of these figures of the last 5 years have been talking to an audience that is not necessarily the federal judge they're in front of, much to the visible misery of some of those long-suffering federal judges. Now, Sidney Powell is still at it. I mean, she's still speaking to both audiences, defending herself in a defamation claim by Dominion, but also making these crazy public statements. And one thing I've noticed is that we have this tendency to think someone's a complete nut and everything they say is ridiculous until they say something that satisfies our priors. Then all of a sudden, we're all over it, thinking, oh, yeah, look what they've revealed. And I thought a good example of this was in this last week when Sidney Powell on a conservative show suggested that the whole point of the January 6th riots at the Capitol was to create a distraction that would eventually lead to delay of the vote on certifying the election results that would somehow wind its way to Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, who would stop the certification of the Biden win. Now, I'm not an election lawyer, but the whole thing struck me as kind of nonsensical. But a lot of people, I think, because they would love to see Samuel Alito and the other people in this crazy theory, including Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, roped into this, are sort of taking it at face value.
Yeah, that definitely raised my eyebrows. I saw the point in the sense that I was pleasantly surprised, I guess you could say, when Congress, after that awful attack, so quickly reconvened and certified the election. I was impressed by that, because I think a lot of us thought after the unfathomable events of that afternoon, oh gosh, they can't just go forward. There has to be some kind of delay. And I think that was the delay that Powell was talking about that would have allowed her to launch this lawsuit. But it did go forward, and then her lawsuit was essentially mooted out. So, but it's interesting. I would not put it past her. In other words, I would not have been surprised if they did mount that lawsuit that she talked about, where they were going to invoke the 12th Amendment, which spells out election procedures, and somehow claim that what had just happened was inconsistent with it. Again, a meritless theory, but I would not be surprised if that complaint got drafted.
No, I wouldn't either if she had filed it. But I guess my point is I'm skeptical of her suggestion that they had on board all these prominent mainstream figures who are going to assist it and make it work. That seems to me to be more fantasy along the constant lines we hear from people like her and, you know, Lynn Wood and even Trump himself, that the Supreme Court is just going to throw the, you know, is going to take care of this.
Yes. And I look, Justice Alito can definitely, he's a definitely a very conservative judge, but there's no way that he, I mean, I think there's no way he would have gone along with that. Remember that he and Thomas and a lot of the other very conservative justices did not bite when Texas tried to overturn the election results of Pennsylvania and other states. They just essentially said, take a walk. And I think he would have done the same thing.
Well, the shadow docket giveth and the shadow docket taketh away.
Exactly.
David Ladd, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show. So thank you so much for joining us. And I hope people will read and enjoy your post. I think it was very interesting, and it's on your Substack Original Jurisdiction.
Thank you for having me, Ken. It's great to be here. I'm a longtime listener of the show after it was recommended to me by a federal judge, actually. So thank you for having me.
Before we go, I want to thank more listeners for becoming members of KCRW in support of this show. Today, Wednesday, is the final day of the station's good old-fashioned pledge drive. Thank you for proving once again that only generous people listen to this show. Margaret in Santa Fe says, All the President's Lawyers is my favorite podcast. I wait for it to drop each week. Deborah in Ashland says, All the President's Lawyers helps me understand why it's harder than I think to put Trump in jail. Thank you to other generous listeners, Timothy in Shrewsbury, Roger in Alexandria, Kent in Denver, Samantha in Torrance, Ruby in Springfield, Robert in West Hill, Ashish in Los Angeles. Edwin in Thailand says, All the President's Lawyers rocks. Maybe a little. Jeff in St. Helena says, ATPL is the only podcast I listen to on the regular basis. It's my pleasure to support it and KCRW. Tell Ken he is a good lawyer. I just hope I never need his services. Well, that's sweet. Unfortunately, this podcast isn't long enough to thank everybody by name, though we'd really like to, but we do know you and we do thank you. If you waited to the last minute to this last day of the good old-fashioned pledge drive, it's here, the last minute. Pause this episode and please go to kcrw.com/give. Once again, your donation is doubled if you give before midnight, thanks to KCRW board members Heather Minkst and Tyler Minkst. Pick up a good lawyer notepad, or send meals to the LA County Regional Food Bank while you're there. And thank you again for your support. If you have questions for the show, send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW, or send us a question at kcrw.com/ATPL. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Ken White. Thanks for joining us. And Josh Barrow and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.